She slides each Mingirero off the needle and lets it dry also on the tray. These two shapes, she explains, are typically made together and served together because they share a cooking time. This starts a loud, friendly argument among them all in rapid Italian with accompanying hand gestures about correct cooking times. I practice my orecchiette. I ruin my first dozen, but then finally get it, and suddenly there I am making perfect little ears right alongside these three Italian women, Rosaria, Carmelucia, and Alda. With more than 40 years between our ages, Alda who owns the house, Carmelucia who has kept the house, and I who have married into the house, we are all at the kitchen table making orecchiette like we are the same. Later, in the evening, I am sitting outside in the front, having an al fresco dinner with Marco at his restaurant, a small wooden chair pulled up to the massive granite front stoop of this villa. He's blonde and tan and in nothing but a diaper, trying to manage tortellini with prosciutto and butter with his own fork, and he's explicit in wanting no help from me. A battered Volkswagen Rabbit slowly pulls in at the end of the drive and comes to a stop. The driver cranks the handbrake and turns the car off, but leaves the headlights on. He gets out of the car, stands at a respectful distance from the house, not to presume. C'è Donna Alda, he inquires. Aspetta, I call to him. I get Michele, Michele gets his mother, and suddenly we are unloading gorgeous Galia melons and red plum tomatoes out of this gentleman's dusty car. This has happened a dozen times over the years that I've been coming here. A woman at the end of the driveway with Giuncata in her bicycle basket. A farmer with a three-wheeled motorized wagon unloading olive oil and eggplant and bringing it into the storage room next to the kitchen. This man, tall and slender, bringing melons and tomatoes. He stands inside the house without touching anything and will not allow himself to lean against the wall or the doorframe even. He is tan. Who are all these people who approach the big house and stand at a respectful distance until warmly welcomed into the magnificence by Alda herself, once she squints and adjusts her old eyes and then lights up with immense warmth and recognition? Who are all these people of the local countryside who bring her things and to whom she has Rosaria bring out a couple of beers at 11 a.m. when they are taking a break from chainsawing the dead branches? There was the woman who made burrata and giuncata, and she used to bring it to the house, still warm, in the basket of her bicycle, until she died a few years ago. This man with the VW and the melons, his name is Cosimino. Alda buys a lot of fertilizer from him for her wheat fields, and he, in turn, buys a lot of wheat from her, which he then sells for a profit. Along the way, he brings her nice things from his garden. Antonio brings the olive oil and cuts down the branches. Carmelucia brings the eggs and her homemade pastas. The transactions and interactions seem so genuine and affectionate, and even without speaking Italian, I can see that these people hold Alda in great esteem, with respect and kindness, and she, I feel certain of it, regards them equally. I study her. I need to know. I need to teach Marco and Leone. I can't tell if I am just learning how to make orecchiette, or if I am learning how to be the woman who keeps the sack of keys. But somehow, July with Alda and the Fortes family has become the most important and anticipated month of my year. Chapter 18. When Michele was first trying to get with me, he made me some profoundly beautiful ravioli. He got up early on a weekend morning and made his dough. And he went to the gym and did two spinning classes in a row, while his pasta dough rested under a towel at home and became smooth as flesh and tender as lettuce. He then rode his bicycle all the way down to Greenwich Village to get his ricotta from Joe's Dairy on Sullivan Street and his pancetta from Pino's across the way, and he rode all the way back up to his apartment on the Upper East Side, the whole thing at least an hour's excursion for just the right ingredients to fill his ravioli. Not to mention 3 hours of strenuous exercise to coerce his 46-year-old body into nail-the-35-year-old girl shape. They were small and delicate and a beautiful yellow from the yolks in the pasta dough, and you could see the herbs and the ricotta through the dough, like a woman behind a shower curtain. For the ravioli, he rolled out his pasta with a rolling pin, like his mother uses, not even availing himself of the relative ease and shortcutting of those stainless steel crank jobs that roll dough on graduated thinnesses until you get to 9 and you can read the newspaper through the dough. He did that instead by hand on a galley kitchen counter the size of a standard ironing board between the toaster oven and the dish drying rack. He cut out each round with a paring knife, not even a cookie cutter, and filled each one by placing the ricotta and pancetta mixture in the center of the round, draping another disc of dough on top, and then sealing the edges with a damp fingertip. He made dozens this painstaking way. I could imagine him in his lab at the medical college where he both teaches and does research. His technician-slash-researcher skills totally utilized, where he gets close up on his task, preparing the Western blot experiment in which he puts a drop of each ingredient, antibodies, saline, dry nonfat milk, onto the gel apparatus using a pipette, a ballpoint pen-like tool that holds liquids, and you click the top to dispense the drop as if you were clicking open your pen to sign important documents. He brought Alda into things early on. I met her the first time when I flew to Italy and met up with Michele on the annual summer month that he spends at home every year. I arrived in Rome, where Michele's family is from, and Alda, his mother, hugged me in the first 3 minutes of setting eyes on me. Michele took me on a motorcycle around Rome all night, very fast, and gave me a tour of his city in the dark, with the fountains and the piazzas and cathedrals and statues high, high up of winged horses pulling chariots across the sky, made even more luminous and more amazing because of their being lit in golden floods against the orange-scented black night. The oppressive heat of the day diminished, the throngs of summer tourists asleep in their hotels. It was just like that. I have loved making my way, imperfectly, around a foreign city on my own. I have loved walking endlessly and getting lost and arriving at the museum or restaurant or store I wanted to go to just as it was closing. Missing the point of my excursion has forced me, on so many occasions, to find the secondary, smaller points. The old woman sweeping out her front yard and putting water out for the cats. The baker cleaning out his ovens for the afternoon. The two kids refilling their shoeshine boxes with polish and clean rags. All of these small moments found only by wandering down a side street behind whichever museum I have failed to get to during its operating hours, or on the one day of the year it is closed for some local holiday I've never heard of. I have loved the feeling of being pummeled by the intricacies of a city, and also loved the feeling of conquering, in small ways, a city by myself, not speaking the language, but eventually finding the right place to get the coffee the way I want it, a good dinner, the train station, the bookstore. I have fallen apart on many train station platforms in many foreign cities, alone and unable to figure out why the scheduled train isn't running. And I have been helped, finally, by some kind person who can see what shit I am in and who has a handful of English words to offer. I have made friends with the man at the kiosk who sells the International Herald Tribune and the street maps in his neighborhood, his city. I have even loved, on a certain level, being the tongue-tied patron in the restaurant who so badly wants to eat what the natives all around me are eating over on their tables, but being too afraid or unwilling to ask. I have loved being the woman who studies the menu so hard and tries to decode the language, digging deep for her 4 years of advanced Latin, hoping that this is a romance language and that that tedious academic effort will pay off, as the mother of all languages must have children I recognize, and that will help me discern, linguistically at least, fish from hamburger. I have loved learning a city the hard way. But I've got nothing bad to say about being introduced to Rome by an extremely capable Roman in a good silk tie who wants, for whatever unclear reasons, nothing less than my heart. So while we rode around Rome at night, eating at tiny, perfect trattoria high up in the no-cars cobbled streets of Trastevere, marinated white anchovies, parmesan omelette, fried cod with zucchini and almonds and buttered bread, and walked across the bridges and made out in public like I would never consent to in New York. His 80-year-old mother, Alda, stuffed and baked tomatoes, cooked turkey leg with oranges, sent her vegetarian daughter out for the best prosciutto, and laid everything out each day at lunch on the dining room table with linen that had been hand-sewn by the convent sisters of the Marcelline order and with little cruets of her own olive oil from her own olive orchards in Puglia. She squeezed my hands in her arthritic ones with powerful emphasis while sitting on the terrace trying to stay cool in the late afternoon for no particular reason, just affection, not in greeting or salutation. And I was hooked, hard and fast. The only words we could say to each other were ciao and ciao, coming and going. I didn't speak any Italian. And Michele took care of me in such a way that I didn't need to. I arrived just in time for the family's trip south, which they make every year to spend the hot summer months at the house in Puglia. Cousin Chiara and Giuliano and their daughter go down to their house in May, sometimes even earlier for Easter. Sister Gloria did away with the trip altogether a few years ago and just moved there into her own house permanently, winter and summer. Brother Giovanni drives down when he can to help with the opening of the main house and readying it for Alda's arrival. Sister Manuela waits for her 16-year-old son's finishing of school before loading up the dog and her stack of books of summer reading and Ando and maybe one of his teenage friends, before making the 8-hour drive, which she usually achieves in something over 10 hours, as she is a steady driver. Brother Carlo, wife Anna, their daughters Agnese and Maria, Anna's sister, Carlo's best friend and workmate Paolone, and his girlfriend Angela, as well as their cat, make the trip in June and stay, more or less, the entire season. Alda takes the train with her youngest son, Giulio, who, at 40, still lives at home because he is Italian, and this is what Italians do if they haven't married. On that first long trip on the motorcycle, when we left Rome early in the morning, Michele brought me a cold apricot juice and a hot coffee as soon as I woke up. He did the difficult work of driving through that relentless, excruciating hot afternoon on the shimmering asphalt of the autostrada, while I sat on the back, lost in the cushion of my helmet, enjoying that exquisite feeling of being totally surrendered, relinquished from all of my responsibilities, even for taking care of my own heartbeat. He drove with care and expertise. He drove fast and assertively. I never felt doubtful. I locked my arms around his chest, leaned into the turns as he had instructed me, and for the rest of the journey spent all those hours on the road, gazing out at the rolling hills and remnants of aqueduct and skinny tall cypress trees, and centuries-old stone barns, and let my mind wander further and further away from the kitchen, the hot stove, the chronic necessity of meeting payroll, until I had wandered so far away from my life in New York that I began to think of books and foreign countries, and I had silvery little fantasies in which I had lived my life as a singer in a small choir and not as a cook in a kitchen. Michele, meanwhile, paid for the gas and had Italian money already in his wallet before I had even woken up to the fact that I was in another country and needed another currency. He had mortadella sandwiches that he had made with just the right butter-to-meat ratio in the saddlebags for our roadside snack under a tree. While I took it all in, the phlegmy diesel rattle of the trucks with whom we shared the lanes, also heading south, their beds empty, while across the median, they teamed north in a military-like procession, loaded to the top of their canvas flaps with San Marzano tomatoes. I knew that we had crossed from Campania into Puglia, that we had definitively reached the south, not by reading a road sign, but by the tiny Fiat we passed, packed to the gills with luggage, and in the front seat, the man driving with his suntanned arm out the window, while his ample wife rode in the passenger seat with her bare feet up on the dash and white cream bleach on her mustache. Both of them were smoking. When we stopped for gas outside of Bari, Michele phoned ahead and had cold rosé wine waiting for us at the house when we arrived. His mother had taken the train. She arrived from Rome at the train station in Lecce and was met by Giovanni, her second oldest son. Alda packs very little for herself. She has one old, worn leather satchel that has her few house dresses, that uniform of widowed women all over Europe who wear the same simple smock dress every day, and all of those women, every widow in Europe, has one drying on the clothesline under the oleander trees while the other is on her body. Beyond that, Alda packs not much more than a comb and her toothbrush and a few photos of her decades-deceased husband, Tommaso Fortes, who died in 1970 at 58 years old from complications due to malaria he'd contracted when he was a kid. The rest of Alda's luggage, an arsenal of crumpled plastic bags left over from grocery shopping and tied at the neck with twine and rubber bands, are bulging with things she needs that she shuffles back and forth between the house in Rome and the house in Leuca. Her pressure cooker, some jars of jam, a kind of biscuit that she likes, and the whole set of good silverware rolled up in chamois sacks and polished for so many years that it looks more white than silver. Giovanni, with his quiet, patient, and unflappable demeanor, is waiting for her at the station and carries all the bags to the car. She walks faster than he does, in spite of her pronounced limp from her hip surgery and her 80 years, 40 of them spent keeping afloat a family with 6 children without a husband. Giovanni drives her to the house, and no sooner has she set her handbag down on the soft, almost powdery stone floors than she is noticing every detail of the condition of it. She pulls the yellow leaves from a plant and sticks her finger, without shyness, deep in the soil to check its moisture. She peers into the waist-high green glass canteens of olive oil, props open the creaky door to inventory the storeroom where the plum tomatoes are stacked in crates next to the laundry machine, amid the drying heads and necks of garlic and the clean, empty bottles for tomato sauce, and by dinner time has already, with Rosaria's help, put fried eggplant and boiled beans and boiled zucchini and giuncata cheese on the table. The house is truly impressive. When Michele and I pulled up to the gate at the end of the driveway, I just shook my head. Unbelievable. There before us sat a Pompeian villa with a large room smack in the center of the house that has no ceiling. It's called an impluvium, meaning where the rain is gathered, and I have often noticed that my son Marco gets as excited about this room as I do when we get to the house every year. What could be more fun, more impractical, more romantic than walking in your pajamas through the room in the center of the house which has no ceiling, and looking up at the sun, sky, stars, or even, as we experienced last year in the middle of the night, as we were frantically moving the dinner table and the chairs and the reading lamps, warlike lightning, thunder, and extraordinary wet winds. Though completely different from the house that I grew up in, I nonetheless also grew up in an impressive house, and so I was immediately comfortable and felt an odd and unexpected familiarity as soon as we arrived. While it is in every respect a true villa, with frescoes and bas-relief and tiled mosaic in the entryway, and the soft stone floors called pelle d'uovo, which describes perfectly the feel of the floors on your bare feet, like the skin of the egg, that thin film of skin that lines the eggshell. I can't help but say villa every time out loud with quotation marks around it, and as if it had 4 L's. Because it's just so crazy and over the top that this guy with whom I was casually starting an affair would have given me nocturnal, glittery motorcycle tours of Rome and then delivered me to his villa in the south, where his loving mother had prepared a simple, beautiful meal of mostly vegetables for our arrival. The only way the story could get more enviable is if I embellished and described Michele as tall, with bee-stung lips and a thick head of dark hair, or if I said that we slept outside by a fire in dew-soaked sleeping bags. Even though we were in this villa facing the sea, with a wide terrace for watching the sunset, and rooms with 25-foot-high domed ceilings surrounding the room with no ceiling, I was seduced only by the meal Alda had prepared. The dense, almost purple beans I'd never seen before. The fresh, bone-white cheese with undeniably herbal flavor. I couldn't wait to cook with her. I wanted to work side by side with her in her kitchen. At first, I needed Michele nearby to translate, but very shortly it became obvious that cooking itself was a way of, if not exactly speaking, at least a way of being together in a room doing something that felt comfortable and interactive, like hunting mushrooms on damp, opportune mornings with your own mother. We both soon grasped that we had that as a language, and I could understand everything she was doing, and she could understand me, too. And for all of the years since, we have cooked together in place of talking. That first morning of my first visit to the summer house, I walked into the big, open, airy kitchen to have coffee, and Alda was at the table, already up for hours, shouting into the telephone, only because the phones are weak and because her hearing is going, arranging her affairs for the day. She checked on the bank, the lawyer, the gardener, the wheat, the olive oil, the hairdresser, shouting in Lecce dialect into the phone the whole time, often the same question over and over, while Michele leisurely showered and shaved meticulously on the other side of the house. She arranged for more olive oil to arrive, for the trees to be pruned, for a haircut from her favorite girl in the nearby town of Giuliano. "Twice as good and half as expensive as the girl in Rome," she laughs, delighted. A woman arrived on her motorino, a bicycle with a small motor the size of a hairdryer you have to pedal to ignite, and pulled from the handlebars basket giuncata and mozzarella cheese, still warm, that she had made herself using seawater, though no one could explain if this was from a parsimony, too poor to buy salt, or an aesthetic impulse to create the perfect balance of salination in the cheese using water she collected from the sea each morning. In the beginning that first year, I felt awkward and tried to feign an appearance of relaxed casualness, as if I were just sipping my morning coffee in the room with this guy's mother, with whom I could not share one word in the same language, like it was the most fluid, easily metabolized thing in my entire day. Really? I was hoping for her to stay on the phone, to receive another food-bearing visitor, to make another call quickly, because even the pause between phone conversations was awkward as she sat there at the table with me, both of us unable to make conversation, she squinting heavily at her handwritten phone/address book, trying to make the numbers come into focus so she could dial another piece of her business. Me, bluffing my way through a relaxed, contemplative morning coffee. But then she opened the old refrigerator that rarely cooled below 50 degrees and threw a plastic shopping bag in front of me, opening it up and showing me what she had bought early that morning at the market, while Michele and I were still in the hand-tatted, lace-trimmed, heavy white linen sheets, barely awake, listening to the Mediterranean breeze flap the flags and cables of the sailboats anchored right out front in the harbor, with a hypnotic thin clank, 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 and the occasional wasp's angry hum of a passing Vespa under our shuttered window. In the bag were half a dozen wild, unruly heads of Italian puntarelle, a kind of bitter dandelion green, different in so many ways from our dandelion here. The stalks were hollow and satiny white, and the tops looked like juicy marijuana buds. And suddenly, with this one bag of humble dandelion weeds, she and I started talking. I held the puntarelle and looked at her questioningly. It was not like what I had seen and known sold as puntarelle in the States. She started snapping the buds off the tops where they break naturally, exactly like you would do with an asparagus spear that will naturally snap where the wood ends and the succulent part begins. I understood what she was doing and started to do the same with the other heads in front of me until we had cleaned the entire bag. She got up and soaked the puntarelle buds in water and then dumped a few cubes of ice in there as well to really crisp it up. I made a very fatty vinaigrette, like I would have for a dandelion salad at home, with both anchovy and pancetta and hard-boiled eggs and lots of garlic, and I fried some bread cubes in her olive oil. And together, wordlessly, we made lunch. I understand only later, years later, that she will do this almost every morning of every summer vacation we take to see her. She will toss me an ingredient she found at that morning's market in Tricase and look at me, expecting me to know what to do with it. A whole fish, an octopus, a piece of hard-to-find meat, hard-dried land snails, lumache, whole wheat grains, pickled lily bulbs, lampashone, a rhizome that looks a great deal like pearl onions. She is always doing this. She tosses an ingredient at me and asks me what we should do with it. I am honored that she thinks I am familiar with all of these ingredients, but even on the few occasions that I am dying to learn what she does with them. The next morning I arrived in my robe for coffee, and she and her daughter Manuela were separating the wheat grains at the kitchen table, like two women playing a quiet, thoughtful game of Scrabble might do. The two women sat at the table in their house dresses, Manuela with her eyeglasses down at the end of her nose, a pile of grains in front of each of them, and quietly, speaking only occasionally, they sat there and separated the husks from the grains. I understood the task immediately. I'd done this in Turkey when I was politely disappearing, and so took my coffee and joined them. Quietly, I insinuated myself into their silent conversation around wheat. Now we all three were sharing an experience. It's not dramatic or significant. It's just a way of communicating. But for me, it is everything. I'm trying to show them that I am a worker, that I wash dishes, that I can help clean the wheat, that I am not some useless burden of a house guest. And it stands in amazingly well for language that we just don't have. Manuela reads and writes and speaks English perfectly, but hesitates, and will do so only when my struggle for a word or to communicate an idea becomes too great, and then she bails me out. And this is how I have come to know Alda, my future mother-in-law, for the first weeks and then subsequent years of my relationship with her son. And then we went to a family dinner. As if the motorcycle tours and the villa and the incredible mother weren't enough, I met strangers who came up to me and hugged me, who gave me kisses on both cheeks, but real kisses with actual cheek-to-lip contact, as if they truly meant it. I met sisters and cousins and wives and best friends who smiled at me as warmly as if I were a cherished daughter. I met old medical school friends of Michele's whose eyes lit up with unmistakable joy and pleasure when meeting me. It was immediately obvious how much these people cared about Michele and how the Italian idea of hospitality is automatically and unconditionally extended to anyone someone they already love loves. Alberto and Rosie, within 20 minutes of meeting me, said, "We love you as we love Michele." It's from Rosie, years later, that I learned to put a peeled potato in the pasta cooking water for extra starch. Meanwhile, the olive trees swayed in the gentle breeze, and handmade orecchiette were passed around, and the wine flowed, and someone handed me my first scroppino, that lively dessert drink of prosecco and vodka and lemon ice cream, which is so named because it describes the sneeze-like sound a horse makes when she's shaking the flies from her nostrils, because it makes you shudder just like that. And that's just how it felt to be introduced to Michele's family. At some extra low point, some years after we were married, Michele and I went to a marriage counselor in New York, and we sat down on the couch in her nice office on our first visit, and we introduced ourselves. As soon as Michele started speaking, as soon as she heard his voice, the therapist lit up and smiled and said, "Oh, you're Italian. Are you Italian? I love Italians." And I slouched down on the couch a little, watching the therapist's face aglow with her own memories of orecchiette and scroppino and olive oil, and I thought, "Oh, no, you don't, honey. You love Italy." What did I love? The man, the country. I loved folding myself into Michele's family and loved how much time they could all spend together, happily, it seemed, without running out of conversation. We could have been with the cousins and sisters and husbands all day at the pool or the beach, gone home for showers, aperitivi, and a costume change, but then at 8:45, when we have all reconvened around the dinner table at one or another's house or the local restaurant, dining al fresco, everybody is talking a mile a minute and gesticulating animatedly as if we hadn't just seen each other over the 5 long, hot, languorous afternoon hours in the shade of the umbrella poolside, as if we had just arrived from the airport 15 minutes before for the first time since last year. At least that is how it appears to me as a non-Italian speaker. It's possible, even likely, that nobody is saying anything but bullshit, but it can feel very satisfying, like a good sneeze, to be enveloped by it. It was a feeling that I wished would continue year-round, but that we, Michele and I, never managed to get a long run on once back in New York. There was something about being in Italy that made it so possible, and I feasted on it in those early years. The scenery was first rate, a villa by the sea, a constant blue sky, a countryside dotted with white truly. Michele's whole family effortlessly received us exactly as we presented ourselves, and we were never inconvenienced by any reference to or inquiry about how we had managed to pass each year's preceding 11 often difficult months of our strange and ill-founded marriage, and so it was almost possible to forget them. When we decided to have Leone, I realized that I no longer wanted to be some girl passing through on the back of Michele's motorcycle, married as a performance art prank. Now I wanted to stay, to be the mother of many children, to be a member of a family, the Fortes family. And I wanted it year-round, not just for this wonderful but heartbreakingly ephemeral month, after which I would not see or speak with or hear from any of the Italians, including Michele in a way, for the next 11 months. My ambivalent relationship to Michele had not changed with the arrival of Leone, but my attachment to family had. I thought a great deal of that empty house that my parents had left Simon and me alone in, and understood that no matter what disappointment I felt in Michele, I would never, ever leave. But for now, at this time, I am still only a guest, a familiar July visitor who happens to bring with her every time she comes a new baby with the Fortes surname, but a guest, nonetheless, for just the month in Puglia. And I was wide awake, prepared even for the fact. I got my shit together, I knew that we would need cash, sandwiches for the trip, cold rosé at the house when we arrived. I arranged for those things myself, even. I bought the plane tickets. I rented the station wagon and remembered to ask for a rear-facing infant seat and a forward-facing child's booster seat. I knew that the lira was out and the euro was in. I got Leone a passport 2 weeks after he was born and signed it for him, writing mother in parentheses. I took Italian lessons. And as we were packing the leased station wagon for that trip from Rome to Leuca, with our double stroller and our diaper bag filled with diapers in two sizes, and the bottles and the wipes, I laughed to Michele. Look at us now, Mr. Motorcycle. We arrived in Leuca after dark and, uncharacteristically, a day ahead of Alda. Her train from Rome was scheduled to arrive the following evening. Before we'd left Rome, she pressed the small, heavy sack of keys in my hand, the keys to the house in Puglia, and laughed, kindly. Now I'm the guest, she said, smiling. I carefully packed the keys in my bag and felt an uneasy buzz of responsibility the whole 8-hour drive to the south. We passed the same remnants of aqueduct and the tall skinny cypress trees and the huge windmills at Tavoliere and the trucks heading north filled with just harvested tomatoes, but now I was inside an air-conditioned diesel station wagon reading Green Eggs and Ham to Marco and nursing Leone the whole time, taking advantage of their naps to eke out any daydreamy thoughts about paths not taken and lives not lived. Still, Michele and I have nothing much to say to each other, and the long drive passes almost wordlessly between us. We drove Michele's customary quick circle of the lighthouse that looks down upon the whole port before continuing to the house on Via Tommaso Fortes. I fished out the sack of keys and opened the tall, heavy door, and Michele put all of our things inside, piling up our luggage in the center of the impluvium. Marco said, in two-year-old talk, "Hey, where's the ceiling?" And we laughed. I turned on the lights in the kitchen and in the storeroom off the kitchen and checked to see what there was. Tomatoes, oil, garlic, melon, eggplant. Exactly as it was every year. Rosaria had been there earlier and kindly left us a meal under dish towels in the cabinet, per Alda's phoned-ahead instructions, surely. Michele opened his suitcases and within 5 minutes exploded like a dandelion gone to seed, his shit floating all over the house and landing wherever it may, wherever he drops it. His eyeglasses, shoes, wallet, keys, camera, a glass of iced tea with a sticky ring left on the desk next to the computer, his cell phone, his newspapers and magazines, all over the kitchen table. I got in bed and nursed Leone to sleep and heard Michele in the next room with Marco having a bedtime story.
How does a dinosaur say a good night?
And I fell asleep at
Does he throw his teddy bear?
Noticing how impossibly thick his already thick accent gets as soon as we get to Italy every year. I rose early the following morning, quickly dressed and went out on my own, with Leone, just 3 months old, strapped into the pouch. I stopped for an espresso and a cold apricot juice at the nearby bar on my way up to the market in the square. I used my accumulated Italian gathered during these now half-dozen consecutive years of summer visits, and I had money in the right currency in my wallet, gotten from the local ATM machine. In the square, I found my ideal kind of man. Missing most of his teeth, with his zipper gaping open, he was selling zucchini blossoms under the shade of a large tree. Guys like this are getting hard to come by anymore, even here in this little Italian town. He pulled back the burlap that covered the wagon of his three-wheeled motor cart and showed me, with shaking arthritic hands, his fresh black-eyed peas in the shell, his dark purple green beans, his zucchini flowers. He had a little crate of imperfect prune plums and small dark green watermelons no bigger than a regulation softball. I take some of everything he's got. I know that when he dies, he's the last, and this, the pants held up with a piece of twine, his work shoes dusty and curling up at the toes, and the simple way he has tossed his wares into the bed of the wagon next to the jug of gasoline and the coil of thin rope and the cracked plastic pails, covering them with a light sheet of burlap, a grain sack split open to make a sheet. This all goes when he goes. When I asked him how much for the zucchini flowers, he said, €1 the handful, and began filling a crumpled-up recycled plastic bag that he dug out of the front seat of his little Ape, the three-wheeled motor scooter made by the same company that invented the Vespa, called the Ape B because it makes that noise with its 50 cubic centimeter lawnmower engine. He ended up giving me handfuls as big as we would call armfuls of the bright yellow-orange blossoms with powdery dark amber centers. There are no more donkeys with wooden saddles, no more community ovens where all the women in the village bring their breads and casseroles, no more tinkling of goat bells in the oregano-scented breeze from a small herd and their herder coming down the mountain, him carrying a tall stick and smoking a filterless cigarette, looking like he's in his 80s. They are all but gone, these kinds of people who make and grow food. Here in this average daily market that sets up each morning in the square next to the bocce courts and the permanent butcher and fishmonger, my Vecchio boyfriend here with his fly gaping open and his posture bent in half is unique. His companions are here in state-of-the-art mobile stalls, clean, electrified dromedaries that carry their own source of running water, traveling stores whose windows pop open on the sides and, eccola, there you are, having your cured meat sliced on the spot, imported from Germany, or even if imported from Emilia-Romagna, it's all the same because we are not in Emilia-Romagna, we are in Puglia. There is smoked scamorza and bread from the hard Durum wheat, salted capers in three sizes from the size of a lentil to the size of a fat green English pea. And there are big bouquets of dried oregano alongside vats of brine things, mostly olives. But the vendors themselves are intermediaries, just merchants. The produce guy wears a t-shirt emblazoned with a currently hip rock band and a huge pair of counterfeit Gucci sunglasses with white, diamond-crusted frames. His teeth are gleaming, his ass is packed into his stonewashed jeans. His hands are clean. He didn't grow it, pick it, water it, or even pack it. It's the toothless Vecchio who makes my pants pound, not Alfonso over here with the hair gel. He has his American counterparts, Mr. Gucci Sunglasses does. The chicks and dudes who drove me from the farmer's market years ago. I love the vegetables, but I can't go near the place. There's always the girl with the bicycle, wandering along from stall to stall with two apples, a bouquet of lavender, and one bell pepper in the basket of her bicycle. A teeming throng of New Yorkers tries to push past her to get to the vegetables for sale, but she shifts her ass from side to side, admiring the way her purchases are artfully arranged for all to see in the basket of her bike, and she holds up the whole process. And I struggle as well with the self-referential new kind of farmer, aglow with his own righteousness, setting up his cute booth at the market each morning with a bouquet of wild flowers and a few artfully stacked boxes of honeycomb and a $15 jar of bee pollen. And from what I've seen, that guy behind the table, with his checkered tablecloth and his boutique line of pickled artichoke hearts in their jar with their prissy label packed just so, he wants to talk to Miss Bicycle, to Miss I've spent 4 hours here this morning to buy these three cucumbers. He gets off on it. I stopped going to the farmer's market years ago when some hipster chick in sparkly barrettes and perfectly styled farmer clothes came screeching at me, "Don't touch the peas!" After that, we just ordered directly from the farm and had it delivered to the restaurant. Of course I'm in love with the toothless guy with the gaping trousers. He's everything I grew up with. He's the end of an era. He's the last of what it was like to just be a good eater and a good grower. A time when we just grew it and cooked it and ate it and didn't talk so much about it. When we didn't crow all over town about our artisanal, local, organic foie-foie. We just went to the farm and bought the milk. I bought everything I could from that old guy. There was a dinner party planned at the Masseria, where the whole summer congregation of family would assemble. And I realized I could put everything, punterella, beans, black-eyed peas, all of it, to use for that meal. None of it would be wasted. At these incredible family dinners, there can be up to 46 immediate cousins, uncles and brothers, aunts, wives, and kids. Everybody brings a dish, and usually the host supplies the wine. I've tried ardently to get Michele to agree to host one over the years, and every time we start to do the count, "What about Cousin Mercedes and Beppe? And don't forget Massimo and Antonella." He falls apart when we get into the high 40s and in danger of breaking the 50 mark. Massimo and Antonella are friends, not family, he'll argue. vainly trying to get the numbers down, knowing full well, without my even having to say it in my impatient and frustrated tone, that they are as close and cherished as any cousin or blood relative. The Italians even have a way of counting that works perfectly for these kind of family dinners that I wish we had in English. If you ask how many we are expecting for dinner this evening, they'll answer, un trentina, a little 30, or una quarantina, a little 40. It's like saying, roughly 20. So we know that we can expect anywhere from 35 to 45 when someone answers, una quarantina. I want this vague yet perfectly precise way of counting in so many contexts of my life. I always want to say everything was 20 years ago, or you cook it for 20 minutes, or I've been a cook for 20 years, or I haven't spoken to my mother in 20 years. But exactly 20? Not for an Italian minute. Exactly a ventina. I am built for this kind of dinner party. It's in my blood, all those childhood lamb roasts for hundreds. It's in my bones, those decades of catering sit-down dinners for 1,500, 250, 900. I really ache to host one, a real one, where no one has to bring a dish. It's possible that everybody, just like that marriage counselor, thinks that everything, once translated into Italian, is just simply better, even a potluck dinner. And in some ways, it is. The food at an Italian potluck is probably a little better than the food at an average American potluck. But there are no two more heartbreaking, soul-deadening words to me in any language than pot and luck put together. The idea of seven variations on a lentil salad and one bottle of lemon-lime seltzer sinks me. And even the one guest who was thoughtful enough to prepare something expensive and complex and warm like curried shrimp, even that person has no idea how to cook for a potluck. And so 18 people stand around the little quart container of the only dish that has any protein and any flavor and try to get a tablespoonful before it's all gone. I dream with fervor all summer long of putting that villa to work. I secretly write menus in my journal that I would prepare if I was allowed to have a party there. And then I even write out the prep lists, the equipment and ingredient lists. I draw little sketches on paper towels. I lie awake in bed at night in a mosquito coil haze, visualizing the dinners I would host there, the concrete order and the watercolor image, the way I would bring that house to life, how I would rake the property of all the dead oleander leaves that have fallen and trim back the trees themselves so that 50 guests could stand on the terrace and actually see, and not just hear, all the boats anchored right there in the harbor, with their twinkly little lights winking, and the shimmering rings of gold that surround each boat in the black nighttime sea it floats in. I long to put a perfect crimson Negroni with a half moon of orange into the hand of each and every one of those cinquantina, wondering if it might not go totally unnoticed that the color of the aperitivo echoes, ever so subtly, the color of the sunset. I long to clean out the broken bicycles and abandoned bedsprings and sagging towers of twine-bound mildewed newspapers and women's magazines that now clutter the summer kitchen, that warren of outrageously handsome whitewashed cool rooms underneath the house where meals used to be prepared in the summer months to avoid the punishing heat. I wish I could store all the tomatoes, figs, melons, and eggplants down there and hang some homemade sausages from the rafters, and tie some bunches of the wild garlic to dry from the big rings that still remain from where people used to tie their horses so many lifetimes ago. I wish I could pull out every piece of Alda's old Salentino pottery and wash it and use it and rescue it from its dark hibernation in the heavy wood credenza. I want to wash all of her charming old crystal glasses and drink from them instead of admiring them every year as I do, shuttered up in their beveled glass cabinet. I want to throw away the harsh lamp with the overbright bare bulb in the impluvium that Giovanni has been repairing for 30 years with more and more and then more black electrician's tape, and let the open sky above us have less to compete with. I want to gather all the trim from the olive trees and burn an immense fire outside, over whose coals I would grill 40 whole fish stuffed with wild fennel fronds picked from the surrounding fields, and dress those fish with the olive oil from the olives of the branches that fueled the fire. And I want to set out lanterns all over the property so that people could wander after dinner. I want to replace the ripped and sagging hammock with a fresh, softly woven one, in which people could canoodle if the Negroni and the grilled fish and the fresh figs happened to inspire them to want to go lie in a hammock and get tangled up in the soft arms of their amore. But as soon as I start to paint that little picture for Michele, before I've even dipped my brush into the can of scenic paint even, all I have to say is, could we please host one of the dinners this year? And Michele gets his black, dark face, his pinched eyes, his wrinkled forehead, like I've just told him he has incurable blood cancer, instead of that I want to feed people delicious food and pour delicious wine and fry dozens of the local eggs in brown butter and sit outside all summer light long and have utter pleasure. Every year he tells me it would be too much for his mother. And that is the conversation ender every time. If there's anyone I totally respect and don't want to burden or tax or upset in any way, it's Donna Alda, nona to my kids, suocera mia, Signora Alda Fortes de Nito. But even when I swear to Michele that I will do all the work myself, or get help from Chiara and Giuliano, who have been known to shove sausages they've made up their own chimney to air dry, and who, I am sure, would help me host a big dinner out in Li Olivi or Sta Villafortes, he doesn't yield. On a small excursion in his wooden boat, Cousin Giuliano once packed in a small woven chest the twice-baked hard biscuits of the region, a few tomatoes, some chili flakes, and a few basil leaves from their garden. And Chiara taught me to hold the biscuit over the edge of the boat and soak it in the seawater for one Ave Maria to soften and season it slightly. And then onto the biscuit we put the tomato, warm from the sun, and the leaves of basil, and ate an impromptu lunch with vaguely cold beers right there in our bathing suits. They would certainly help me with a party, I am sure of it. Michele stands between me and everything he has introduced me to, everything I now want, all of it sprawled out in plain, delectable view just behind him, all of it unattainable without him, and oddly, impossible with him. He will not budge. We will not be hosting a dinner party. What about a nice Sunday lunch? I suggested one year, thinking that if I switched up the hour of the day, I would sneak one past him. But I believe he knows exactly what to say no to be sure he is breaking the very heart that has never quite convincingly felt him all these years. He's nothing if not smart, Mr. MD/PhD. Without him, I don't get the family. Without the party, without the building of the fire, the lighting of the candles, the rushed and hectic preparation all day of the food, without the hiss, hiss, hiss of the blood hitting hot coals, I will never find consolation. Alda arrived in Lecce the following evening and was retrieved from the train station by Gloria, her third oldest child. Gloria is a radiant beauty who dresses in flowing, colorful fabrics and long, dangly jewelry and kind of floats through the house with a perpetual beatific smile on her lips and a bemused twinkle in her eye. Gloria seems unburdened, happy, and physically healthy. She is quick to light up with laughter, and while I have never once seen the family darkness shadow her eyes, turning them black and impenetrable, as I have seen in the other siblings and even in Alda, she does kind of fabulously wilt in the heat and dramatically heads off for rests and afternoon repose, like Blanche Dubois. She arrived with Alda and helped her into the house. Alda immediately, even at 8 o'clock at night, went from room to room, the clack of her heel on the floor from her uneven gait from the hip surgery, and her staccato little exhale echoing in the 25-foot ceilings in all of the rooms as she passed through them, checking on the olive oil, the tomatoes, the potted plants, the bedding. Gloria cooed at the babies, and her pleasure in seeing them permeated the house. Yet another Italian woman, perfect with children. Alda pressed a large tray of homemade biscotti wrapped in paper onto Gloria to take back with her to her house, and a disproportionately wild frenzy ensued. In part, I understand, because Italians do it this way. Even the most simple transactions have to become wildly gesticulated and vociferously argued, and in this family particularly so. How many cookies should Gloria take with her? Not all of the cookies, mamma! Take the cookies, amore mio! Gesticulations, raised voices, overlapping shouting. The decision? Leave us a few and take the rest. We all at last said goodnight, and amid much Italian gesticulating and urgent tones, confirmed that we would all reconvene the next evening at the Masseria for a family dinner with everybody. It's true. When we had the family dinner at the Masseria that year, the renovated farmhouse and the olive orchards where Carlo lives in the summer with his family, Alda did run out of steam, sort of validating Michele's resistance to a party of our own. But honestly, not until the very end of the race and not more than a yard short, frankly. And certainly, it had been my fault. Alda, rising early the next morning, before the heat of the day had taken its rank, had cooked all morning with Rosaria, and when she had finished her mozzarella pizza and her eggplant parmigiana with hard-boiled eggs, she went to take her little late-morning nap. With the kitchen now free, I started prepping the treasures from my old farmer man. Nursing an infant in the first few months really sucks up the day. I never get over it, and I'm always totally taken aback by the amount of time in a day it takes to nurse a baby. When you are all and solely what they eat in the beginning of their lives, which I am in the habit of being for about the first year, Marco a little longer, Leone a little less. It could be, if you are a less driven and energetic person than myself, about the only thing you accomplished in a day, certainly in a vacation day. But I imagine the total sensory pleasure for the kid to pass out at the tap, belly full of that rich, sweet, good stuff, and then he is in a little incomparable sleep coma with his cheeks still smashed up against the warm boob firmly and securely held in the arms of his mother. And so I tend to give my kids their 20 minutes of nursing and then their 20 minutes of post-hookup nap, undisturbed, in the very position they fell into it in, regardless of my own discomfort, arm cramps, or list of shit to do that day. If you do the math of that, in pure 40-minute increments, factoring that an infant needs to be fed every couple of hours, well, an 8-hour day can really fly by, and what I used to accomplish in that time gets reduced to a maddening fraction, a whisper more than zilch. And on this day, I aim to cook 4 separate dishes, the puntarella, the lecce beans, the black-eyed peas, the zucchini flowers, each to feed 25 people. I cooked all day, all afternoon, in between lunch and siesta, after siesta, even during the siesta, in that still, empty, depressing part of the day when everything is closed and no one is outdoors and the houses are shuttered. And I cooked in between a half dozen nursing bouts with Leone, until I was still assembling the platters at the last minute, right up until we were leaving for the party at 8 o'clock that night. Alda, in spite of doing her own cooking for the party in the early morning, had helped me all day. After her nap, she sat at that kitchen table, trooping through with me, corroborating my ambition. She cleaned the puntarelle, shelled the black-eyed peas, tipped the green beans. She'd held the fussy baby, entertained Marco, made me a coffee, as if I were a guest. And I'd had this feeling all day that we were working together toward the very same end, that my mother-in-law and I were busily and mutually engaged in our goal, generating enough delicious food for our contribution to the large dinner party we would be going to later that evening, where we would finally sit in the cool comfort of the olive trees, drinking excellent wine, watching the kids run around, being enveloped by the comforting din of Italian bullshit. Michele, and I live for this kind of old-world genius, took a stack of large clean dish towels out of the drawer and opened each one, set a finished platter on it, and then by drawing the 4 corners of the towel in and knotting them, he created a built-in carrying handle and a way of keeping the food wrapped to carry it to the car. No saran, no foil, no Tupperware. Beautiful Salentino pottery wrapped in heavy, clean dish towels. This is one of those old-world anachronisms, like when your mother would hard-boil eggs in the morning and pop them in your coat pockets, piping hot, to keep your hands warm on winter mornings as you walk to school, and then you had part of your lunch ready in your pocket when they cooled by midday. That retains such beauty and efficiency and clever, simple invention that you never let it go, even with the advent of plastic cling wrap and the microwave oven. While Michele, with cute help from 2-year-old Marco, carried the many platters to the car and packed them neatly and snug in the trunk, I rinsed off, combed my hair, and put on my dress. As I was hastily heading through the house to get to where everyone was waiting in the driveway, turning off the lights in some of the rooms on my way, looking up at the purplish and pink-streaked evening sky as I crossed through the impluvium, I saw the light on in the clean, empty kitchen. I breezed to the doorway and reached in to turn off the light, and there sat Alda, in her nightgown, at the kitchen table under the harsh light, eating a bowl of cold cereal with milk for dinner. An unspeakable sadness overwhelmed me. I felt inexplicably abandoned. I ran to get Michele. Alda's in the kitchen, in her nightgown, pouring a bowl of cold cereal. Your mom's not coming? I asked Michele, my eyes stinging. What the fuck? I couldn't help welling up and needing to look away. Michele came inside with me and we went to see his mother, sitting happily and peacefully in the kitchen with her cereal. Keche, Michele asked, and his mom rattled on in cheerful but exhausted tones. Michele turned to me. It's too much for her. She doesn't want to go, all those people. At this, I laughed out loud, as if all those people were some large group of tedious work colleagues from some other floor or department in your company, and not her own sons and daughters and grandchildren. And Alda reiterated, confirmed from her chair, E troppo per me, troppo, Gabriel, vai, vai, amore mio, divertiti. Go, go, have fun, it's too much for me. Suddenly I saw that she had aged. Alda was getting to be old, old like a grandmother, exhausted at the end of a day, ready to sleep alone, in the lumpy comfort of her horsehair bed, surrounded by her heavy, old furniture. It's got to be something, that kind of tired, where you are not simply tired from that day, but an accumulated fatigue from the past 29,000 days, where even the dinner meal with a crowd seems like too much, and just a cold bowl of cereal at the kitchen table alone is what you can or are willing to muster. In the time it takes to switch off a kitchen light and notice a figure at the table, I saw that I was going to lose her, sooner than later. During the hottest hour of that day, while Leone slept and Marco went to the pool with Michele, I had sat with Alda, wordlessly shelling the black-eyed peas that I'd bought from the 100-year-old farmer. They were so tender and young that their black eyes were actually pinkish-purple, and their bodies were still the palest green, not yet dried into a chalky, withered, tea-stained white. Some were as small as grains of arborio rice. They reminded me of that amusement park memento where they paint your full name in black ink on a grain of rice and then put it in a tiny glass bottle of mineral oil and string it onto a necklace. We split the pods open with our thumbnails and slid each pea out into a colander set between us. What I have loved about cooking my entire life, especially prep cooking, is the way that it keeps your hands occupied but your mind free to sort everything out. I have never once finished an 8-hour prep shift without something from my life, mundane or profound, sorted out. A new way to organize the walk-in, an opening and closing line for an essay, a way to prepare the zucchini, a likely reason I came to long for my green card marriage to an Italian man 11 years my senior to become something other, deeper than a piece of performance art, and why it never quite became that thing. Not two handfuls into the black-eyed peas, it started. What am I still doing here this many years later? What am I still doing in this marriage with someone I don't know and who doesn't know me? This was also intoxicating my first year. The simply boiled vegetables, the meat-like eggplant parmigiana, so charming that I wrote an essay about it for the New York Times my third year. And now this, my fifth year? My sixth? Oh yes, I remember. It's only our fifth visit, but it's our sixth year fooling around. There was a year when we were fighting excessively, and Michele canceled the trip after I'd already bought the tickets because he didn't want to subject his family to our domestic frost. I said, really? You think the family won't be able to handle our garden variety marital shit? Can't we just do one of the very few things we do well together and take the lousy trip to Italy this summer? No. And that's how we've been together here only 5 and not 6 times. I am sure he was right. We would have fought, and I am prone to it, big and cathartic. The marriage counselors in their tidy offices tried to teach us the therapeutic tune of the moment, a horrible song of constant restraint in which you may speak only of your own feelings, which I experienced as having a constantly full bladder but never being allowed to let it out but for a tablespoon at a time, with nil relief. We tried it, the concessions, the conscientiously held tongues, the supposedly edifying reiteration of those catchphrases that all ill-suited couples resort to, mantra-like. Marriage is hard work. Marriage is a compromise. But I like to break the furniture, throttle the bastard's neck, hurl epithets across the room, and narrate the exaggerated story with myself as the innocent. All of which I will cheerfully apologize for in the morning, but not until I have drained all the poisons, every last drop. In hindsight, I can see how it's good that we skipped that year's annual July visits. Michele, by contrast, was raised to see anger as vulgar and unintelligent, so his, unexpressed, steadily seeped into our life like lead leaching into the public drinking water, which I've heard is what brought down Rome. I have no way, it occurs to me looking over at Alda while we shell peas, to canvass her to know how she would have felt if we'd come anyway, in spite of our marital discord. Over the years, I've picked up some Italian, but with her it doesn't work. To her, I remain incomprehensible. Michele says that he thinks the reason I have become relatively able to communicate with almost everyone else over the years, but not with her, is that she has become more and more deaf. So just as I've become vaguely conversational, she's tuned me out. But I sense from the way she is about everything, so extremely patient, so good-natured, the way she addresses all of her children as amore mio when they enter the room or call on the telephone, that she would be able to metabolize anything we would have brought with us, no matter how flu-like. We shell the rest of the peas and start tipping the beans. Alda offers me something to eat from a platter of something unidentifiable that she's had stowed away for 2 full July days in the dish cabinet. I was seduced that first year by her boiled vegetables, and totally enamored with her dish cabinet with corks and espresso plates and leftover fried eggplant all jumbled in with the mosquito coils and the bottle caps and the 15-year-old dried dead herbs in jars. But as she's proffering that plate of something I believe to be fried bechamel that has sat uncovered next to and on top of the mismatched espresso cups, the bags of dried pasta, among the moth-infested polenta meal, and the jars full of soda bottle screw caps, I start to unravel a bit, without letting on. A little spider of disappointment crawls down my back as she's handing me the plate of undercooked bechamel, still tasting of raw flour, rolled in breadcrumbs and fried. It's her great-grandmother's recipe. But I need a meal, a full meal, a hot meal. I need fresh food that hasn't sat in the propane oven and then in the dish cabinet all day. I need a steak. I need something I can't name. I need to take all of the shit off of this table, this beautiful old granite top table, and put it where it belongs. I need to be a wicked American, a total Italian failure, and put the ironing in the laundry room, and the cookies in the cookie tin, and the scrap paper in the scrap paper drawer, and the diaper cream in the diaper bag, and the keys in her key pouch in her purse, and the batteries for the camera into the camera so that here, on the kitchen table, we can just shell black-eyed peas. No, grazie, I say, and continue tipping the beans. She returns the bechamel balls to the cabinet for day 3. Of course it's not her. She still holds my hand sometimes and cuts open sea urchins for lunch and fills my suitcase with linens and silver for the children as we pack to leave each year. Of course it's Michele. He would never break a chair, but we will never throw a dinner party together in Leuca, I am sure of it. Over the years, he has never once raised his voice to me. Rather, he has quietly and steadily, item by item, withheld the glitter, the motorcycle rides, the silk tie, the sandwiches, the spinning classes back to back, the sunset Negronis, the cold apricot juice and hot coffee in the mornings. And now, like that long-ago plate of courtship ravioli, I am left with the inedible contents of those gorgeous little packets, undernourished. I should have known from those ravioli, those many years ago when he was so heavily courting me, and he painstakingly made those ravioli and presented them on a paper tray, so tender and translucent and beautiful. When we cooked them for family meal at the restaurant the next day, we took special care to use a slotted spoon to remove them from the water. And we browned a little butter with a few leaves of rubbed sage, and we all took our first bites and had to spit them out immediately, they were so inedibly salty. Michele had failed to blanch the pancetta and additionally had over-seasoned the ravioli filling, and so those several dozen handmade gorgeous little beauties, which looked so enticing and appealing from the outside, went to waste as we opened them up and took out the filling and ate only the few bites we could salvage of the empty pasta, alone with the butter and sage. I should have paid attention to that. Chapter 19. On a Sunday at the Brooklyn Children's Museum, I started to get hungry, just as Marco was beginning to fully appreciate the 12 types of drums that he was allowed and encouraged to bang on with different mallets and sticks. I said to Michele, who was holding Leone, now 8 months old, "We'd better start to make our move. I'm going to need to eat soon." People who know me well understand fully what I am saying when I suggest that I am working an appetite and that we'd best be making our move. This means it is time to hit the road before my blood sugar, what's left of it, crashes to that point where I'm going to ruin your fucking day. My friends dive into their pockets, backpacks, and purses and proffer any peanut, energy bar, lint-covered M&M that they can lay their paws on, because friends are great like that. They can see what's happening from where they are standing before you can. Even though I'd done a decent job of recognizing my hunger signs at their earliest appearance, and duly notified the family that it would now be a good time to start making our move, making our move from the African drum room to the Volvo station wagon with the stroller, the umbrella, the boots, the coats retrieved from coat check, the bathroom pit stop, and two small children still in diapers buckled into their safety seats, doesn't happen as fast as my appetite comes on. But once they were all buckled in and I had the forest green wagon in reverse out of our parking spot, I had a burst of ambition. "Hey, Michele," I asked, "wanna try for a real lunch, like with wine and silverware, like in a restaurant? Like we used to do?" Which I didn't say out loud. Michele looks at me for just the few seconds he needs to assess where I am in the hunger scheme of things, like a tree scientist who can tell exactly how old a redwood or an Adirondack spruce is by the rings in its flesh. And he takes a look at both kids, estimating them both close to falling into a nap, and says, "Sure." We were still well out of the extreme danger zone. Chris Grill, the friendliest man on the planet who was Prune's daytime sous chef for 5 solid years, knew the danger zone at every shade of yellow, orange, burnt umber, and into full code red, and he would gently suggest a peanut butter sandwich just from reading my tone at a kitchen meeting. But we're still out of the danger zone, comfortably in a pale yellow mood, and I'm driving, feeling A-okay. I catch Michele in the rearview mirror and say, "Hey, a real lunch, with wine and stuff. This sounds awesome." "You know, we don't do this kind of thing anymore." We have become, to each other, all parents all the time. We eat plain buttered pasta at dinner every night, and even that we don't eat together, because the way we have worked out our childcare and career schedule requires that one or the other of us is home alone with the kids while the other is enjoying his or her late night at work. We sleep in separate beds in separate rooms, each with a kid, or more usually, me with two kids, him snoring alone for the few hours before his alarm goes off while it's still dark, when he has to get up in order to get to and teach his 8 a.m. lecture on the liver or the nervous system or the structure of the cell. We look at each other as units of labor to be bartered, traded, and assigned. "If you take Wednesday night, I can work that private dinner party, but then I'll take Thursday night so you can go to that lab meeting. But Sunday, I need to check on brunch for a few hours, okay?" We are not really in these days seeing in each other much of a lunch partner, more like a relay race partner. This is kind of a tragedy, since there are only a few things we really have in common: food, an exorbitant love of and attachment to his mother, and the thing Italians I think are kind of known for, the luscious business, which we no longer very often have the energy or the inclination to seek out in each other. We still call Nona on Saturdays, but aside from that, all the good stuff, the wine, the food, the deed, the stuff that cushions you against the central loneliness, has been triaged to the urgent and utterly consuming demands of parenting two children under the age of 3 while maintaining full-fledged careers. So, in some burst of energy, for me to suggest an actual lunch, braved with two children, gets us both excited. But it's about 3 in the afternoon on a Sunday in the dead of winter, and we are deep in Brooklyn. Not the section of Brooklyn where white people push strollers around, but deep in the section of Brooklyn where we now live, Bed-Stuy, where there is no such casual Italian place where we could have a late 3 p.m. lunch with wine and cutlery and a tablecloth. Or if there is, we have not yet found it. Michele and I had just a few months earlier, upon return from our Italian vacation, begun the experiment of living together, which we had, in spite of our 7 years, 2 children, and a City Hall wedding, never done. but the kind of space we thought we would need if we wanted the experiment to stand a chance was only to be found in a comfortably impermanent 2-year sublet far out in a section of Brooklyn that, while it had 3,000 square foot homes with generous backyards and many shuttable doors, did not have any restaurants. We could have gotten some excellent curried goat, probably, or some not excellent fried chicken for sure. There was a Bojangles or Popeyes on every corner. But we didn't really know our way around yet, and besides, I wanted old times, nostalgia, our past, a tablecloth. I started to drive not knowing where I was heading, and at first the excitement and good cheer kept my hunger at bay. I knew something good, real, and adult was coming. I could wait. But there immediately appeared some signs of resistance to our brilliant European lunch idea. Every place I called on my cell phone in every neighborhood in Brooklyn where I could think of a place at which I wanted to eat all said the same thing. Not open until 6 p.m. for dinner service. I called a little-known, decent neighborhood place called Locanda Vini e Olio in Fort Greene and the excellent Al di là in Park Slope and was turned away. So I then even called Peter Luger, the famous steakhouse in Williamsburg, reasoning that I would happily sink into a burger and a gin martini, even if it was not exactly the broccoli rabe with pepperoncini and braised rabbit that I was craving. A burger would work. But the woman who answered just laughed me off the phone. No chance of a burger, honey. I start to get a little orange and less yellow. Not yet red, no, but still, one ring closer to the danger zone. Michele's got me in the rearview mirror, keeping an eye on me the way you might keep yourself aware of where the scorpion is in your room when you check into the hacienda you booked in Tijuana. You are game for an adventure, but best to know where the scorpion is at all times. Now we are heading toward the slope and looking for Mary's Fish Camp. I've decided I will, at this point, happily sink into an excellent lobster roll and a beer at a counter with plain paper table mats. I make the call, and they also won't reopen until 6 p.m. for dinner service. Brunch until 3, dinner at 6, said the outgoing message. So now it's done. I am tanked. And just at that moment, Leone started to cry his pitiful, not-so-little, falling-asleep cry. I have never understood the heartless Ferber people who let their kids cry it out. If you are inclined to view your 3-month-old infant's cries as manipulative, as a means of discovering if she can get you to come into the room and pick her up on command, then you should rethink parenthood in the first place. I don't think you are mature enough, frankly. An infant, to be sure, can't haul herself downstairs and help herself to a glass of water, can't call upon a good friend at 2 a.m. to discuss the finer points of her fears and anxieties. I feel compelled, involuntarily compelled, to pick up and try to comfort my child when I hear him wailing. My hormones shake like a passing tank when I hear children on an airplane, not even my own, wailing in distress. I long to just pick them up and comfort the little guys. After all, they are crying. I'm going to assume they are crying for a good reason. Even if it's just an infant's run-of-the-mill, pick me up and hold me because I'm afraid of falling asleep, because sleep is like death. For me, that is a good enough reason to pick up and hold my kid, so that he may feel, at a minimum, accompanied to his perceived death by someone who gives a shit. Michele doesn't feel as I do, unfortunately. So there I am, stuck in the driver's seat driving, cell phoning, and having a blood sugar crisis, while my 8-month-old expresses his perfectly good reasons for wanting comfort to his totally unpersuaded father, who is able, somehow, to sit through the tears completely nonplussed, while giving me friendly suggestions about some $8.99 brunch place he used to eat at with his old girlfriend 20 years ago. And you get a free mimosa, he tells me from the back seat. Meanwhile, I don't eat $8.99 brunch with a free mimosa. I have rules, standards. I do not get vague or generic appetite, which will be satisfied more or less with just anything that is handy. I will skip a meal rather than eat the corner joint's interpretation of Eggs Benedict with spinach, button mushrooms, and blood orange hollandaise sauce. I don't eat that kind of shit. Michele, from the back seat, kept saying, I remember a place, very good brunch, up here on the left. But when we approach and I see the chalkboard on the sidewalk advertising free mimosa, I speed up and drive on. Free mimosa is the kind of signal I rely on to stay away from a place. Why is the mimosa free? What is wrong with a place that it needs to provide the customer with an incentive to eat the food? On the other hand, things are now kind of urgent, and a mimosa would really soothe and refresh. I'm saying things I don't mean, that I will later regret, and that Marco is sure to repeat as soon as he can think up a way to work them into a sentence. I'm saying things like, maybe if I just order poached eggs and toast, it won't be so bad up here at the Red Potato Bistro.